Welcome to Gluck Radio. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, executive life coach and master problem solver. Today, we're happily joined by Dalton Conley, author of the book Parentology, Everything You Wanted to Know About the Science of Raising Children Were But Too Exhausted to Ask. There are as many approaches to parenting as there are children. But Conley isn't just another self-help guru. He's a scientist who's done the most influential research on child rearing. Why did he give his son the longest name in New York City? And why did he get a vasectomy so his already born daughter would be smarter? Some might call him strange, even selfish, but by using research on everything from vaccines to family values, Conley will lay down an inarguable groundwork for your own parenting style, whatever it is.
What can we learn from the French and Italians when it comes to parenting? In a culture of helicopter parents and participation trophies, could laying low truly be the right way to go? Conley's children call him expletives, and he often bribes them with money. Is he an incompetent dad or a parenting visionary?
Dalton, welcome to our show.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't we just start off with the question, is parentology. Why did you name it? Why did you name your book after it? And what is it?
So it's kind of meant to be more of a fun a new word that I made up to explain my kind of experimental approach to parenting. And the argument I make is that all parents are kind of experimenting on the fly, doing the scientific method of generating a hypothesis about their kids, testing something, and then revising their hypothesis, whether or not they're conscious of that or not. And it's a particularly American style of parenting, given that we don't, as an immigrant culture and as a young country, we don't have, you know, common ancient Taoist traditions or something like that to guide how family life works. But really, it's meant to be a fun book that tells the stories of my own quirky family and meant to assuage all the anxiety that parents feel in today's inequality world.
Okay, so it's not meant to be a hard science per se, but rather just for everyone to take a look at their own methodology of parenting. You know, have you found, by the way, in history, a particular methodology of parenting that you particularly like?
Well, I think that, America and any aspect of culture, we pick and choose. You know, we have, you know, combination Italian Chinese restaurants. We have, you know, Mexican sushi and things like that. I think that's how we do it for parenting, too. In my own personal, I would encourage everybody to borrow what they want from various cultures. In my own personal style, I'm part, Asian tiger mother parent, and I'm part, hippy dippy 1970s parent. So, for example, I'm very intense on my kids in terms of making them do extra work besides their schoolwork to kind of develop their cognitive skills, their academic abilities. But then I'm very lax, unlike a tiger mother, when it comes to things like, I let my kids curse at me if they want, but only one of them takes me up on that.
What were your goals, in the end?
I know
you talk about
my
no, you talk about societal merit badges and what other parents want. But I think what you were trying to inculcate is something like perseverance, self-discipline, and all of that. But I was just curious to know what the goal of your scientific approach was.
Well, it's really no different than any other parent. I want, it's not complete 70s style hippy-dippy parenting where I just want them to be quote-unquote happy. I want them to be successful in an increasingly competitive world. We do know that from research that as important as, academic ability or IQ are non-cognitive skills, what economists and psychologists call these non-cognitive skills or soft skills, which include, yes, some of it is social relationships and, how you can socialize with people of different ages, but a lot of it is what you mentioned, grit, perseverance, focus, ability to deal with defeat or disappointment, and so forth. So those are really important, and you know, I want to promote those as much as I want to promote, you know, knowing advanced math or being able to read complicated texts.
Now, how did private schools factor into all of this? That's quite a story.
Yeah, well, so my, what I, kind of can be kind of daunting as a parent when you know too much research. So, for example, I know that schools matter a lot less to kids' outcomes than we think they do as parents, or that we worry they do, and we spend so much time obsessing over what schools our kids go to. There's been studies, for example, by Alan Krueger and co-authors, who he was Obama's chief of the Council of Economic Advisors for a while. He's a Princeton economist. And he shows very ingeniously, for example, at the college level, that if you get into Princeton, but you choose for whatever reason to, for financial or because you have a sick parent or whatever, you go to you know, your local state college and commute or something like that, you do just as well in life later on. Likewise, at the high school level, the MIT economist Josh Angrist looked at kids who would just run either side, literally like by 1 or 2 points of the cutoff to get into the elite magnet schools in Boston and New York. And, you know, really, that's kind of like a random assignment. One kid knew one more vocabulary word that happened to be on the test, or one kid had, you know, a worse night's sleep the night before than the other kid. One kid got lucky and the other kid didn't get lucky, and one gets to go to the, you know, elite magnet school and the other kid doesn't. And so when you look at those two kids, essentially, there's no difference in their outcomes later on in terms of SAT scores, college, and later in life. So we know that schools don't really matter that much. But at the same time, you know, just in case, parents, of course, want to send their kids to the best possible school. It's a sign that they're doing, you know, they feel like it's a landmark that they're on the right track. And it's also, you know, just in case schools do matter somewhat, why not send your kid to the best possible school?
But Yo had a horrible experience.
Yeah. So my son, I was kind of, you know, as I mentioned, I think most parents are kind of making things up as they go along, and sometimes that leads to disaster. So in my case, I didn't realize that the attendance in fourth grade mattered in the New York City public school system. I thought it was fifth grade in terms of getting into the middle school of your choice. And so my daughter went away for part of fourth grade and missed a lot of school, and was then therefore not admitted to any of the schools we chose for middle school. We at that point explored private schools, this being right after the 2008 crash in Wall Street, so we thought there might be a lot of room. And we managed to sort of get the kids into one school that they really liked and was very excited about, my son. Because it was small classes and a more seminar discussion-based format, and he couldn't just kind of zone out in the back of the class, issues of ADHD came to the fore. And so we had to deal with that, and that became a whole other drama that's still ongoing.
Dalton, let me ask you a couple of questions, because one of my pet peeves is that people need licenses to do manicures, they need licenses to cut hair and fix cars, but they don't need any license to bring life into the world and, you know, to make people a citizen. So two questions. Is that what should be a priority before a person even considers being a parent in terms of what they should know? And two, every single child is different, so you can't have the same parenting style. I know I have two children, two girls, they're now 35 and 30, but one of them, when they were bad, would meet me at the door with a strap and say, "I think I deserve to be hit 3 times." and she would get spanked, and I have to make up a mad face because it was impossible not to. And she would thank me, kiss me, and that would be over with. The other one, God forbid I touched her, she'd throw herself down the steps, so I could never hit her. So the second question, I know these are two big questions, is shouldn't there be a total adjustment to the kid's personality? So you can answer either one first.
That's very difficult to do when you have two or more kids, because then, you know, the kids cry out that it's not fair, that you give each kid what they need, not what they want necessarily, and you treat them differently. Anybody who has two or more kids becomes a convert to the notion that that genetics do matter. For example, that each kid is so unique, and you do the same, you try to do right by each of them, and they come out very differently in terms of personality and achievement and so forth. So, I think that's part of what I was trying to say, is that there's no one size fits all, even within one family for different kids, that you have to adjust what you're doing. So, for example, my daughter was born 8 weeks premature, and we had to make major decisions about whether or not to give her steroids while her mother was in labor to try to speed up her development process in utero, but we knew there was going to be long-term effects of that and so forth. So what I'm advocating in this book, through, I hope, funny stories, is to say that, especially today with Google Scholar and the accessibility of information online, parents shouldn't just blindly accept what doctors or teachers or whatever authority figures in the world tell them. They should research what's right for their specific kid. So in that case, we ended up agreeing to get these shots of steroids, even though they might have long-term negative consequences for our daughter. But those are the kind of, I wouldn't say life and death, but close to that, important decisions that parents have to make routinely.
Dalton, how about the prerequisites of being a parent? If you were the one who were writing the rules, what would you demand as a prerequisite?
I'm not that kind. I'm more of a libertarian when it comes to family, so I wouldn't say I had any prerequisites. What I would suggest is that people, educate themselves about the child development literature, by just reading online and knowing everything that they do, whether they give the kid a daily vitamin, what they feed them, what they name them. I give my kids very unusual names, and I'm often questioned about that. And, and I can point to the literature that shows actually unusual names can be very helpful to a kid. So I think I would urge that it's not like, of course, Dr. Spock said it's not, just trust your instincts and it's natural, but I would say trust and verify. Go online and see what, let's take a decision to breastfeed or not.
Tell our audience what your children's names are and tell me how they did through life with those names.
So my daughter's name is E, the letter E, and that's meant to be the first letter, and she can choose what it stands for. So it could be, L. I thought she would go through a phase when she's a teenager and want to rebel and be normal and be Ellen, my mother's name, or Elizabeth, or something like the Eleanor. But so far, she's just picked E and stuck with it, and she likes the uniqueness of it. And after you name your first kid E, but we didn't turn around and name our second kid John. We picked Yo Xing, and the idea of that is kind of a play on words that Yo Xing, his initials are YX, the chromosomes for males. It's like Yo Crossing. It's also a Chinese name if it's said in the second tone in Chinese. So it's meant to confound people's expectations. Plenty of times Chinese families will give their son or daughter an Anglo name like Howard Chung, but rarely do we kind of have reverse assimilation where a white kid, European descent, takes on an ethnic name. So we wanted to run with that. And my kids love their names. Even though I've been called a child abuser online, it gives them a sense of unique identity. Everybody in their school knows who they are, even if they don't, it gave them kind of instant notoriety. And they, of course they can't know how it would have been otherwise, but they definitely feel attached and don't want to change their names at this point.
I want to ask you about your teaching methods and the way that you read to them, That's laudable. But I had a little problem with the math, the way that you bribe them to learn math. That seemed extrinsic rather than intrinsic to me. And a little bit like a Skinner box, you know, where you feed the pigeons whenever they do something right.
I wouldn't go there. Yeah, I didn't lock them in a box, but close. No, I did bribe them to do extra math. I mean, you're right that there is some literature that you imply that says if you give extrinsic rewards, like external rewards, rather than the reward of, you know, intrinsically having completed a hard problem yourself, just for the, you know, the pleasure of that itself, then you undermine the intrinsic motivation. Now, that has been in experiments where, you know, they tried to get low-performing disadvantaged students to do better in math and do better in school in general. That has been shown not to really erode intrinsic motivation, i.e. the increased performance, increased devotion to studying math or science or whatever, persists after the reward is removed in the experiments. So, but that was certainly a worry. And so for reading, for example, which I think is something you do need, the goal is to develop a lifelong passion for reading, for books, and for reading anything. I never gave a bribe or a reward for reading at all to my kids. But for math, which for the most part, you know, you tell me how many folks you know, as adults, like, I'm going to do some math for pleasure now. I'm going to sit down, had a rough day, I'm going to work out a few problems.
Actually, I was one of those kids.
Yeah.
Yeah. I loved math, and even before I went into first grade, I was doing algebra. And my parents really had nothing to do with it because they didn't even know algebra, but I had a love for math.
Okay, well, you're weird. You're one of the one in 500.
I am.
I mean, it's great. And we probably should do more to do that. But for most kids and particularly adults, that, you know, doing math for fun is not going to happen. And I wanted to kickstart them to get them comfortable. The worst thing about math is to fall behind, right? It's totally linear, and if you fall behind early, then you're doomed, right? So I wanted to keep them sort of ahead of the game. And I did use bribery, you know, for better or for worse. I don't think I eroded their intrinsic motivation. I don't think they're going to end up mathematicians, but they definitely achieved a level of math I don't think they would have otherwise, and, you know, enough to pass the really big high-stakes tests here and all that kind of stuff. Now, what was the negative consequences? For my daughter, nothing. She really is not motivated by bribes or money anyway. For my son, yes, my household has been turned into a Turkish bazaar where everything is, okay, how much are you going to pay me to do that? Well, what do I get? You know, and there's definitely a cost to that, but I think it's kind of funny, and maybe there's a benefit of that long run, and he'll end up being an agent out in Hollywood or something. Who knows?
But putting them on what I thought was really funny and interesting, another form of bribery, was putting them on a treadmill while they watched television. I thought that was very unique.
I don't know how anyone would do it today, starting with young kids again, because I was lucky enough that their very early childhood was wasn't pre-internet, but it was everything being online, pre-Netflix, where you could Google and find any TV show online and watch it on your computer. So we were able to sort of keep them away from TV by just not having a TV in the house. Eventually, like I said, the internet replaced TV, and kids could watch shows, and when they're supposedly working, they could be on the computer watching TV shows or whatever. And so I just made a deal where if you want to watch TV, one of the worst things about TV is that your metabolism slows down and you do nothing. You're like a blob on the couch. You can watch TV, but just walk on the treadmill while you're doing it. And so much research shows that standing and walking is really much more healthy than sitting or lying down for extended periods. So That was one of, I wouldn't call that exactly a bribe, but more of a quid pro quo.
Now, you made this statement, and you need to explain. You wrote in your book that you had a vasectomy because you wanted your kids to be smarter. How does that work?
I'm sorry, that I did what?
You had a vasectomy because you wanted your kids to be smarter. So what's the connection between cutting your junk and the kids being smarter?
So, first of all, I hope your listeners are getting the tongue-in-cheek aspect of a lot of the book. It's meant to be lighthearted. But yes,
it really is.
One of the big most important variables in predicting kids' academic achievement is the number of siblings they have. So basically, parental investment is a, you know, you might say, I love all my kids equally. Love is not a pie. My love is infinite. That may be true, but everything else you have to give to your kids is fixed. It is limited. And if you have eight kids, you're just going to be able to give less to each kid in terms of time, attention, monetary investment, and so forth than if you have one or two kids. So what, in my own research, I found that basically after two kids, then the real cost set in, and kids, particularly in the first and the last born, still do okay, but the middle group tends to be, on average, disadvantaged academically. Of course, there are middle borns that are 4.0s at Stanford, but in general, it's disadvantageous. And they're fighting a two-front war for attention if you're in the middle, and they kind of get lost in the shuffle, the Jan Brady syndrome. So I had my own motivations for stopping at two kids, but it certainly was also on my mind that they would probably do better academically if they didn't have any more.
I think you're right about that. I think the truth of the matter is we have limited resources. But I want to ask you this. It seems like we're always, to some degree, adjusting necessarily to the child or to the environment or to the time in which we live. But are there not certain basic rules of parenting that are not only histrionic, but they just make sense? You know,
it's hard to say. I think that, don't waterboard your kids. I don't know. There's very basic. There's, even corporal punishment. You mentioned about being hit or hitting kids. I was hit as a kid, and that social norm has totally changed today, where child development experts at least claim that doesn't help anything and it's really bad. On the other hand, there's emerging new research that says that kids, if you give corporal punishment in a controlled way to your kids, it's not so bad. Not if you fly off the handle angrily and then hit them. That just demonstrates a lack of self-control and that you're modeling for them and showing them that's okay. But if you do it in a controlled way where you say, okay, you did this, you're going to get, a spanking later tonight or whatever, and it's very organized, that it's not as bad. Now, I don't know, we don't know in the long run whether physical corporal punishment really is damaging, but certainly that's the norm now. But in 10 years and 15 years, research could show that it's better than timeouts and all that.
I think it really has to deal with the kids, because when I was growing up, there was tons of corporal punishment, and I never resented it, never bothered me. It was no big deal. And like I said, my older daughter would not deal with it, but my younger daughter did. So I think it does start. But the one thing I guess that I would have difficulty with is, the old commandment, honor thy mother and thy father. I would have a big problem with my kids cursing me out. Mm-hmm. I would have no problem with them disagreeing and saying they think I'm wrong and they think that I'm mistaken and they think that I'm not really paying attention or listening to them, which I would back off and listen. But I would, and have always insisted on a degree of respect, I am not their friend, I am mm-hmm. their parent. Mm-hmm. Do you feel, even though obviously we disagree a little bit, but do you have any thoughts about that?
I don't think that's, that I'm not arguing that I'm right and you're wrong or vice versa. My intuition was based on research that's not, directly on this point, but I and my own observations as well, that I I saw that kids who were raised by extremely authoritarian parents, where they were really expected to behave to their parents with total respect and not be able to let their hair down at all, let that out, let that frustration out in the public sphere, and were tended to get into more trouble and be engaged in more delinquent behavior out in the world. And I think that kids need a release valve. They need to be able to yell let basically let their frustrations out of a day or whatever. And I much rather them do that at home in private than out in public. So I do, if my son says something, a curse word in a sentence, I'm not going to make a big deal about it.
Oh, no, no, I'm not. And I agree with that. I think letting the kids' frustration out and letting them be themselves is perfectly legitimate. But saying, I hate my fucking teacher is different than saying, you're a fucking asshole to your parent.
Mm-hmm. Well, my big thing with cursing, I think, is that it shows a lack of precise verbal expression, right? Like, my daughter never said a curse word in her entire life, literally. When she wants to insult her brother, she's much more effective than he is. We're calling her a bitch or something like that, which means really nothing, right? She'll say something very precise and I think much more devastating because she doesn't rely on the shorthand and the laziness of curses. So I did want to add before, though, that I never would let my kids curse me in front of other people. And we're really talking about my son because my daughter's never said anything. I wouldn't let them yell at me. I wouldn't let them. I expect exactly that kind of respectful treatment that you mentioned in a public setting. And I expect them to do that not just to me, but to every. I'd be much more upset if I heard them talk back to, the subway conductor or something like that, or a teacher, than I would be if they did it with me. And I would at home. And I would be sort of the middle ground. I would never let them do that to me in public either. That's front stage behavior. But I want them to learn that you in civil society, you act civilly.
Yeah, I love that concept of front stage and backstage behavior, which comes from Irving Goffman, my favorite.
Right. Mm-hmm.
I want to get to the backstory, though. This is what interests me. You say that you either replicate your own upbringing or you disavow it when you raise your own children. What about your background, and how did that affect the way you raised your children?
That's interesting. I don't remember saying that, actually, but I wouldn't disagree with it. I was raised, back in the day, it was much. I had corporal punishment for my father, as I mentioned. At the same time, my parents were artists. Even though they were artists, they weren't hippies. They had a very regular life. They never traveled for work. We had dinner at the same time every day, and it had a whole routine. And that might have been great for me, especially in the 1970s when the rest of the world was so chaotic.
Sounds like they were Protestant artists.
Yeah. Some of that, the kind of artistic aspect, I've reproduced, but, social norms are so powerful that, like I said, I would never, I couldn't imagine people in my community hitting their kid today the way I was hit. I couldn't imagine being left as kind of a feral child the way I was in the 1970s. Basically, parents might say, did you do your homework? And you say, whether it's true or not, yeah, I already did it. And that was it. They did their job in checking on you. They used to have I think they still do, those public service announcements. It's 10 p.m. Do you know where your kids are? I mean, today's parenting is so much more involved. And that's, again, I don't know if that's better or worse, but it is what it is. And it's probably more attuned to the nature of the economy today, which is we need a lot more skills today. It's a knowledge economy. And if you just let your kids raise themselves, essentially, they're not going to get those skills they're going to need to succeed in an increasingly technical economy. So I think the norms change, in, you know, not just willy-nilly because we're rebelling against our parents, although that's part of it. I think they change because the economy and society changes around us.
But, Dalton, isn't that a contradiction of what you said prior in terms of that? And I am also a libertarian, but I do think that the skill set that you just expressed, the ability to understand the complication of the world in which we live and the necessary and the necessity for certain EQ as well as IQ, that doesn't come from a parent who's uneducated.
Right. I'm not following. So
When I asked earlier, you know, are there any prerequisites for being a parent? You said no. You know, I mean, whatever happens, happens. But yet, who would have these skills unless they, in fact, would develop within themselves, or they had proper parenting, or they went to school and they read books, or they knew something about what it's like to actually prepare a kid to be successful in the world in which they live?
Of course. I mean, sure, being educated as a parent is a huge advantage over not being educated. Having had, you know, impulse control modeled for you as a child by your own parents and by other adults is a huge importance when you go and raise your kids in terms of whether you're going to fly off the handle when they frustrate you, and then you're going to model lack of impulse control to them. All of that's true, but I don't think, you know, that means that there should, you know, we can say there's got to be a parent license like there is a driver's license, and we're going to regulate people having kids or not.
I want to ask you about the school system. What is wrong with the school system? What's right with it? I mean, is it just a conformity factory? I mean, not to paraphrase Mae West, but I will anyway, education's a great institution if you like institutions. I mean, it seems like it's an assembly line just to produce children who, you know, are quiet in class, follow directions, and conform to a certain community standard.
I think that is partly true. I think that actually, you know, we don't have as much of that in the United States as they do in other countries that kind of that beat us out on the average. I think the U.S. is much more of a sink or swim kind of place, meaning that we actually work to do creative educational systems where the kids engage and respond critically and don't just memorize things. But that can often mean that kids just sort of think. But the ones that do thrive in that and do succeed end up being, you know, the next Mark Zuckerbergs of the world or Bill Gates and invent things. So I think that our school system, and also what school you're talking about, we have such inequality in types of schools. Some big comprehensive high schools are just, there might as well be juvie halls. They're just babysitting kids from 9 to 3. So parents can work, and others are really engaging and among the best schools in the world. So I think there's no single sort of mode for American schooling. Other countries have much more sort of common standards and common approaches that if you go to one school in France, in Lyon, it's not going to be that different than a school in Marseille or Paris. But I think we're crazily different. We have local control. I was just going over the biology Regents exam that my son has to take this afternoon. Last night we were studying, and I was looking at, you know, giving him some questions from the old exams. And in New York State, there was all these questions about Darwinism and evolution. And I was thinking, I told him, if we were in Alabama, you'd also have questions on intelligent design, or they would just leave this whole section off to avoid the controversy. And, you know, so just by state, there's these huge differences in what we teach or what's acceptable or what we want to produce in the kids. There's definitely schools that just want to produce conformity facts. You know, people learn those skills, sit down and be quiet, and that's it. But, you know.
That was my experience.
Yeah.
And it drove me absolutely crazy. And John Dewey had the most wonderful idea. I mean, his concept was that you had a classroom, and then around the classroom were places where you could actually practice what you'd learned, so that you weren't bolted to the seat the whole time absorbing information, and you were continually interacting. So
that's that kind of critical engagement aspect of American education at its best. But you know, when kids don't come to school with certain prerequisite skills, then it doesn't work, and we end up medicating them, or you know, just disciplining them to sit through school. And you know, it's not. I think there's an issue now of, because the economy's gotten so technical and so demanding in terms of how much you have to know to succeed. You know, you have to take courses in computer science now in high school. Those are more critical than anything, but that's just on top of everything else now. So it's no surprise that we have a ADHD crisis in boys in particular in our middle and high schools, because we're expecting them sort of to do more homework. My son goes to the same high school that I went to 32 years earlier, and the workload is so much more intense now than it was then. And, you know, it's no wonder that we need to medicate kids to keep them going at the level we're doing. And yet still, you know, we apparently are not keeping up with the South Koreans or the Finns.
Is this productive in the long run? I mean, I talked to a third grade teacher, and she said, well, the truth is that we plug them full of all of this knowledge, and then they get to Harvard and they want to play with blocks. I mean, you get to the university level, and it's a party scene.
I'm not sure, you know, if that's cause and effect. I mean, definitely the culture at American universities is different than it is in other countries, where, you know, kids are finally let out and they want to get fake IDs and drink and binge drink. But I don't know the trends on that, whether that's going up or down. And we have an issue in higher education to address how kids make this transition from living with their parents to the residential college experience and being semi-independent. I should say, though, that sort of percentage of college students that are, you know, going through four-year colleges and living on, you know, away from their parents on campus is actually only 25% of college students. Most people work, stay at home, live with their family, and so forth.
Dalton, you seem to have been and are an incredibly involved parent, and you really did your homework, and I could hear it in your voice and just in everything you're saying. Was your wife equally involved in the parenting process, and were there differences in your parenting style that caused you guys to eventually separate and divorce?
Definitely. The way I put it is that I'm the mom and she's the dad. You know, if you think about the 1950s roles, I didn't quit my job, but I was the one who was much more at home there, you know, while her work required her to travel much more than mine and so forth. So she was more like the dad traveling salesman.
Wait till your mother comes home.
Exactly. So that caused, as much as I consider myself, you know, an enlightened feminist, and I'm not attached to particular traditional roles, it still created a strain, I would say. But, you know, hopefully my kids got something from both of us.
How are they reacting now to the divorce?
I think that we had enough conflict that they were relieved at least some part of them was probably relieved when we separated finally. They didn't have to, you know, walk on eggshells or have unhappy parents around. And now she and I get along better than ever. So I think, you know, how you divorce is as important as whether you divorce or not. And model that for our kids.
Yeah, a good divorce.
Mm-hmm. We're much better as exes than we were as married.
I mean, here's a question I have starred. Do you believe vaccination is largely safe or it's hazardous for children?
Oh, I think it's totally safe. I think that's a that's just sort of, you know, the right wing has its some crazy ideas, and I think this is one of the ones that the left wing has. Same thing with GMO food.
Yeah, you know what I love about your book is the notes. The notes are as interesting as the book itself, and sometimes will reverse what you say. And it's especially true when you get into organic. What's your expression? Organic is good for you, or something like that.
Well,
You won't panic.
Yeah,
if it's organic,
don't panic.
Yeah,
that was the motto at Berkeley.
Right, right. But then you backpedal in the notes about that, and I think that's really interesting because obviously, you know, everything organic is not positive in the least bit, especially poison ivy, foxglove, and so on.
Right. Well, on net though, that's why it's in the footnotes, because on net, I think there are certain things that you probably want, we don't know, but you probably want to avoid for your kids. I don't buy organic milk, but I really should, because milk, you know, all the hormones that they're pumping up in the cows to produce a lot of milk is going straight into the, you know, into your kid's body or your body, and who knows what that's doing. So I don't think you have to be a complete, you know, eco-Nazi, but I think, you know, erring on the side of not putting unnecessary chemicals into your kids' bodies is probably good. But it's very expensive. I mean, we all know that a gallon of milk, you know, it could be $3 if it's regular, and it's at least double that if it's organic.
For sure. Let me ask you this question, and this is a question I get all the time in my practice. You have put a tremendous amount of time, effort, energy, and fun in raising your children, but I'm hearing a tremendous amount of thought. What do you believe your children's obligation are to you now and in the future?
Now I just want them to behave and get good grades. In the future, I expect them to take care of me. when I decline, which I expect is going to be pretty soon. So I don't know.
Are you serious or joking?
He's kidding.
I'm sort of serious, sort of joking. My father is in bad shape, and he's pretty young. So I think that's a sign that I'm going to need them sooner rather than later.
No, just keep that humor up, and you may just last to 90 before you fall to pieces.
Believe me, this is an ironic, very fun, very, very funny book. In addition to being a serious one.
I try to get the kind of latest cutting-edge science, some of it not even published yet, into the hands of the reader or the parents, but where they don't even realize, it's really a humorous book, so they don't really realize that they're learning a lot about the science of child development.
Dalton, we want to thank you. We could go on and on. Unfortunately, we don't have the time, but you've been absolutely fabulous. Your book is fabulous. And I could see that's something that you just wrote, that's something you lived. So I appreciate every single word of it.
Yeah, bravo.
Thank you so much.
Bravo. And best to E and Yo.
I will pass that on. Thank you.
Thank you, Dalton.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
I want to once again thank Dalton Conley for appearing on our show. Go ahead and pick up a copy of his book, Parentology. It's on Amazon.com. Interesting, Betsy. You know, I couldn't help but think of my own parenting style and where I went right and where I went wrong. You know, my parents, my kids would probably say I was the best parent in the world, and I would like shake my head. And I don't want them not to believe that. I don't want to be the one to tell them that, but I certainly don't see it that way for myself, just because I had so little time and I wanted to put so much time into it. But it did seem to me that he did a tremendous amount of research, and for him, you know, to have those kids prepared for life, he really went out of his way to try to make that happen.
He really did. I was really impressed by his style. The way that he parented was improvisational, and it was ironic, and it was adjusted to each child. And then the book itself is interesting, the way that he presents serious ideas with a quirky spin. I thought that was really effective. I mean, you're going to read this. You're going to love it. And I also, though, had a little question about his real agenda, which he never talks about. And that is, he really wants his kids to do well academically, to make it big.
I think he does too, but I think that every parent wants their children to well, depending upon how influenced they are by society around them. Some want them to do well to have a better life. Some want them to do well because they don't want to be the talk of the town that their kids didn't do well. So it really, but him, I get from him that he wanted them to do well because he felt that he put the time and energy and effort into it, which I feel he did, and that he felt that if they didn't do well, the alternative was going to be not so good.
Yes, and then in the notes, he qualifies all of that. And he said, look, all I really want these kids to do is to graduate from high school and not get into drugs and to get married and have children, you know, and to look after me, is what he said on the show.
Right, but every parent says that. I just want you to be happy. And the kid says, I want to be an artist. Well, maybe not an artist. Okay. You know, I want to be a carpenter. Well, maybe not a carpenter.
Hey, his parents were artists.
His parents were, they were Protestant artists. They never traveled and they never left the house.
And they ate dinner on time.
And they ate dinner on time every single day. I never heard that in my life. I am Dr. Errol Gluck, and Betsy and I both want you to remember, to every problem, there is a solution. Now, please, we have passed our 100th episode. Check out our other episodes on gluckradio.com and have your friends do it as well. That's what social media is all about. And if you haven't already, you need to go out and buy Betsy Prelow's books on the art of seduction on Amazon.com. They're entitled Seductress and Swoon, which is now in paperback, which you know what that means. Keep listening. Keep sending in your feedback. Till next time.